Last time somebody asked a very good question, what is a hyperbolic structure? And I gave a rather short answer, saying it's a Riemannian metric on a manifold of constant sectional curvature minus 1, which is perhaps the truth, but not the whole truth. So I thought I'd spend a few minutes saying a bit more about how a topologist thinks about a hyperbolic structure. And I thought I'd start off actually with a Euclidean orbifold. So how does a topologist maybe think about a Euclidean manifold? Well, one way is you start out with the how do I think about the Euclidean torus? You start out with the Euclidean plane. And then you have a group of motions, so you have two translations, and you quotient out the plane by this pair of translations. That pair of translations is a kind of a discrete group of symmetries of the plane, and here's another discrete group of symmetries of the plane. It's I've drawn a kind of part of an infinite tiling of the plane. It's some kind of symmetrical pattern. And it's made up of triangles with the letters F and B written in them. And it's kind of it's symmetric, and F stands for front and B stands for back, and so you should imagine the Euclidean plane being covered by this. And then there's a group of transformations of the plane to itself, Euclidean isometries, that preserve this pattern. And if you decide that you're going to identify two points in the plane, if and only if there's one of these transformations that takes one point to another point, what you end up with is a compact space, and that's drawn at the bottom. It's actually what's called a Euclidean orbifold. The quotient here, to start with, there's a kind of fundamental domain made up of two of these triangles, one labelled F and one labelled B. And the point is that if you move this pair of triangles around by the symmetries of this pattern, then the images of this pair of triangles cover the plane, and there's kind of no overlapping. The kind of images only meet each other along edges.
So what you're doing is you're projecting out by a set of translations and a set of rotations?
That's right. Yeah, all the symmetries here is a group of translations and rotations. And when you quotient out by that, what you get is this object at the bottom. You should think of it as taking this triangle, and then one side gets glued to the other, these two sides get glued, and these two edges get glued. And so you've kind of got a triangular envelope, two triangles, two isometric triangles glued along the edges. So that's a perfectly fine Riemannian manifold, except at these three points where you've got, locally it's not a manifold. The angle around the red point is only pi instead of 2 pi, and the angle around the green point is 2 pi divided by 6 instead of 2 pi. So this quotient object is, topologists might think of it as, well, it's the quotient of the Euclidean plane by a discrete group of isometries. So how one thinks of a hyperbolic manifold, one way to think of it's a similar kind of thing, where you think of
if you take the triangle F and you look at the group of reflections in its edges, is the group you're talking about an index 2 subgroup or not?
Actually, the group I'm talking about is orientation preserving. So this pattern, there's a symmetry which is a rotation around the green point of order 6.
Yeah, I'll point the screen.
Oh, yeah, there's a... yes. This pattern, if I've done it right, it's supposed to be a rotation by 1/6 of a turn around the green point, a rotation by 1/3 of a turn around the blue point, and a half turn around the red point. And, of course, you can do that with other points, and you can take compositions of those, but there shouldn't be any reflections of this.
But I should index 2.
So it is this index. Yeah, right. Yeah. So yeah, yeah, yeah. So if I took the full group of symmetries of this pattern, there would be a single triangle, and this is the index 2 orientation preserving subgroup. Yes. Sorry. So what you have is kind of the quotient. Topologically, it's uninteresting. It's a two sphere, but there's more information than that. There's a metric on it with these singular points. And all you need to know, actually, well, so the singular points of orders 2, 3, and 6. There's a particular metric on here, and that this object determines a group of symmetries of the plane, a discrete group of symmetries of the plane. So you can think of this object as it's a metric object, or you can think of it as shorthand for a group of symmetries of the plane, and you recover this object by identifying points in the plane whenever there's a symmetry taking one to the other. So, of course, you can do the same thing in any number of dimensions with Euclidean space. You can also do the same thing with some other metric space, for example, the hyperbolic plane. So the hyperbolic plane is a metric space which, to a first approximation, is a bit like TWA. So I don't know if TWA still exists, but it used to be that if you wanted to fly between any two places on TWA, you'd fly to St. Louis and then you'd fly out again. And so somehow the shortest point in the TWA metric is you always go to St. Louis. And to a first approximation, so you've got the hyperbolic plane is a metric on the interior of the unit's disk in the complex plane. And to a first approximation, the shortest distance between two points involves going to the center of the disk and going back out again. Now that's not literally true, but what is true is that there's a formula for the metric, and in this metric, the distance from the center of the disk to the edge is infinite. The distance, the hyperbolic distance between two points near the edge is enormous. This green curve is a hyperbolic geodesic, and if you want to go through two points, if you want to the shortest distance between two points very close to infinity, well, you don't quite go through St. Louis, but actually you go pretty close, because that hyperbolic distance isn't very far. Hyperbolic plane is sometimes described as the sphere of radius minus 1. And the reason for that is, if you think about the sphere of radius 1, or the sphere of radius r, that is a metric. You can measure distances on the sphere. If you use stereographic projection, you can think of points on the sphere as points in the plane. And you then have a new notion of distance in the plane, where the distance between two points x and x prime in the plane, in this new notion, will in fact be the distance between the corresponding points on the sphere under stereographic projection. And so you can write down a formula for the infinitesimal distance element between points in the plane, and you discover that this new distance is the normal Euclidean distance between the points divided by a scale factor. And the scale factor depends on the radius of the sphere. It's this number lambda, and it's 1 over r squared. So if you look at this formula and you let the radius of the sphere go to infinity, lambda goes to zero, and this metric is approaching Euclidean metric. You get the hyperbolic metric by taking this formula and plugging in lambda equals minus 1. Since lambda is the reciprocal of the square of the radius of the sphere, in some sense that corresponds to a sphere of radius the square root of minus 1. The sphere is, of course, a very symmetrical space. Therefore, if you write down this formula for the metric on the plane is the spherical metric in disguise. Therefore, this formula is a very symmetrical metric. Therefore, you expect that if you change this parameter to be minus 1, you'll still have a very symmetrical metric. Therefore, you discover the hyperbolic plane this way, and you suspect that, in fact, it's going to be very symmetrical. It is. An isometry of the sphere is uniquely determined. If you have an isometry of the sphere, it's a rotation. An orientation preserving one's a rotation. It's uniquely determined once you know where one point goes, together with a tangent vector at that point. And the same reasoning tells you that if you have an orientation preserving isometry of actually any two-dimensional Riemannian manifold, you know what that isometry is once you know where a point goes and a tangent vector goes. And because it's so symmetrical, in fact, you realize that the group of orientation-preserving isometries of the plane are uniquely determined by a pair consisting of a point in the plane, comma, a unit tangent vector at that point. So those are the isometries. Here is a picture of some hyperbolic wallpaper due to Escher. And the point here is that it's a tiling of the hyperbolic plane All the devils are the same isometrically. You can't quite see these, they're angels, they're all isometric. There is a group of symmetries here, the orientation preserving symmetries that send devils to devils and angels to angels is a discrete group of isometries of the hyperbolic plane. If you quotient out the hyperbolic plane by this group, you get a pair of triangles like we had in the Euclidean case, but this time there are cone points labelled 3, 4 and 4. For example, there's a rotation of order 3 around the blue point. That Euclidean rotation is also a hyperbolic rotation. What's harder to see is there's a hyperbolic rotation around this red point. It preserves hyperbolic distance but not Euclidean distance, and it sends this devil to that one and so on.
Can I suggest the screen?
The screen, yeah. So you can rotate around this point by order 3, or you can rotate around that point by order 4, or that point by order 4, and then the quotient ends up again being topologically a two-sphere with three cone points on it, three special points. So this is a hyperbolic orbifold, and it's a metric object. It determines a discrete group of isometries of a hyperbolic plane. So what is a hyperbolic structure on a manifold? Well, you can think of it as a metric on the quotient object. You've got a particular kind of nice metric on the, say, the three manifold. Correspondingly, you have a discrete group of isometric transformations of hyperbolic three space. And the quotient of hyperbolic three space by that group is the manifold you first thought of.
Isn't this a little bit of a strange way to classify things? Because as you say, that's a two-sphere, right? So if you let those points relax, it'll turn into a positively charged object.
So when you think of this as a two-sphere, you're throwing away information. This is a two-sphere with extra information. It's an orbifold. And the extra information is there are three special points, and in addition, those points are labelled 3, 4, and 4. And then it is in fact a fact that there is precisely one hyperbolic structure on the two-sphere with cone points of these particular orders. So there's more information, it's not just the two-sphere. When we're dealing with manifolds, we're not going to have any of these special points, and there would be no hyperbolic structure on the two-sphere with no special points. And when you're dealing with three manifolds, if you're not dealing with orbifolds, there are no special points, and so.
Convince either that that's unlike the two-sphere if you show that the Euler characteristic is negative.
Yeah, so there's a notion of Euler characteristic here. The Euler characteristic of a space, you take the alternating sum of the number of cells in each dimension. Well, you have to modify that formula for an orbifold. In some sense, I mean, you'd think this point counts as a point, but in some sense it's only a quarter of a point. So when you work out the orbifold Euler characteristic, this point doesn't count one, it counts a quarter. There's a correction. That point only counts a third. When you work out the orbifold Euler characteristic this way, you end up with a negative number. And in fact, that negative number, if you multiply it by 2 pi and put a minus sign in front, will give you the hyperbolic area of that orbifold.
So even though that's true, you classify it topologically as a sphere?
The underlying topological space of this object is a sphere, but there's a classification of orbifolds. So there are 17 kinds of Euclidean wallpaper. Or is it 15? Whatever. There's infinitely many kinds of hyperbolic wallpaper, and to classify hyperbolic wallpaper means to classify two-dimensional compact Euclidean orbifolds. And so this pattern is determined by this data. And you can spell out the data this way,
So the difference is between topology and geometry.
Yeah, there's a difference here between topology and geometry, and I'm cheating a little bit here. This topological object with this extra information, there happens to have a unique hyperbolic structure. As I discussed last week, typically in dimension 2 there are moduli and there's more than one hyperbolic structure. In dimension 3, when you're dealing with a closed manifold, if it has a hyperbolic structure, there are no moduli, there's only one hyperbolic structure. And that's what makes it's so powerful, because if you know there is a unique hyperbolic structure on a given topological object, any geometric invariant, such as, for example, the volume, is automatically a topological invariant. There's another way, by the way, so another way a topologist would think of a geometric structure is you take a polyhedron. Well, here you take a polygon. The polygon would be a pair of triangles here, and you identify the sides in a certain way using isometries. So in general, you can think of a hyperbolic manifold of dimension n as you take a hyperbolic polyhedron in n-dimensional hyperbolic space, and then the faces of these this polyhedra are glued together in a certain way, determined by the discrete group. And when you've made those identifications, you've got the manifold you're thinking about. So in a very down-to-earth way, you can realize a hyperbolic manifold as some hyperbolic polyhedron with the faces glued together somehow. And again, what's wonderful is that in high dimensions, if it's a compact manifold, the structure, the geometric structure, the hyperbolic metric is unique, and so you get all these powerful invariants. Okay, so that was a longer answer to what a hyperbolic structure is. So could we have the light on, please? Something I said last time wasn't quite right. I was talking about volume, and I mentioned that, first of all, somebody asked about the smallest volume manifold. The guess is that the smallest volume closed manifold is the Weeks manifold, and its volume is 0.9427. That would be the guess. In February of this year, Agle and Dunfield proved that the volume of a closed manifold is always bigger than 0.67. The first lower bound on the volume, I think, was due to Bob Meyerhoff in the 80s. And I don't know what his lower bound was exactly, but it was something like 10 to the power minus 5. So we've come a long way. However, there's a logical problem here. Last week I said one day we will know the 500 manifolds of smallest volume in order. There is a logical possibility that we won't. And the problem is the following, that you cannot always decide if a number is zero or not. So what do I mean by that? You can compute a hyperbolic structure in a very concrete way. If you have a closed three-manifold, you write down some polynomial equations, you solve those polynomial equations, and in some sense that's a hyperbolic structure. You want to find the manifold of smallest volume. You take that data and you have to evaluate a certain transcendental function from this data. The function is minus the integral from 0 to theta of the logarithm of the modulus of 2 sine theta d theta. You chop up your manifold, if you're lucky, into ideal tetrahedra. Each ideal tetrahedron's got some angles in it. You manage to compute the hyperbolic structure exactly. You know what the angles are. You plug those angles into this function. You've now got a linear combination of transcendental numbers. You do that for manifold number 1. You do that for manifold number 2. You've now got 2 transcendental numbers. You put them on your computer, and to 10 decimal places, they're the same. Unfortunately, there is a possibility that they're different, but you can never prove it. If they're different and you calculate enough decimal places, you will eventually discover it, that they're different, and therefore you'll know which manifold is smaller. There is a logical possibility, though, that these two transcendental numbers are equal, but you can't prove it. So there is a possibility, in theory, that we will never know the smallest manifold for this kind of logical issue, but that seems unlikely. You can prove they're different, and you're not sure which one has smallest volume. You guess they have equal volume, you can't prove that, and you can never calculate enough accuracy to show. So there's that issue.
You might if you were patient.
No, in a logical sense, you'll never know. If they're different, you will find out eventually because your computer will tell you. If they're the same, you'll never discover that. You'll just sit there waiting till eternity.
So you told us two ways constructing these manifolds. One is that business with knots, and the other is by orbital folding the hyperbolic space.
Yeah, so... So one way to construct a hyperbolic manifold is to somehow come up with a discrete group of isometries, quotient add hyperbolic space by that, and hopefully end up with a closed manifold. That's method one. Of course, there you've got to manufacture these discrete groups. Method two, if you start off with a hyperbolic manifold with a cusp, for example, I talked about the figure eight knot last week, and you glue in a solid torus, most of the ways of gluing in that solid torus will give you a closed hyperbolic manifold. And once you've got that closed hyperbolic manifold, you can get the discrete group and you can get the polyhedron. So if you start with one method, you can produce the other and kind of vice versa. And there's a program in my office that does it called Snappy. Yeah.
So just to follow up on this logical possibility, one of the Hilbert problems is about dissecting the polyhedron.
Yeah.
And it turns